Earth, sky.
The key drivers of energy demand growth is population growth, but also economic growth. Now, at the moment, we have 6.5 billion people on Earth. That's about twice as much as 50 years ago. And we're going for around 9 billion people by 2050. Now, all those people, they want prosperity. So they want their economies to grow. And especially the emerging economies, they need particularly, say, relatively to us in the West, more energy in that early phase of economic development when they industrialize and when they buy the first cars, etc.
You are listening to Wim Thomas, and this is Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science, presenting this program in partnership with Shell. Mr. Thomas is head of the energy analysis team in Shell's Global Scenario Group. Scenarios are stories created with scientific tools that analyze the large-scale trends and developments to paint a picture of possible energy futures. Corporations and other groups use scenarios to understand how today's choices can be expected to play out in the coming decades. Mr. Thomas is an expert on Shell scenarios related to the global energy system. In early 2011, he spoke with Earth Sky's Jorge Salazar about what scenario analysis suggests about the future of the world's energy supply and demand.
Mr. Thomas, what's the most important thing you want people today to know about scenario planning for energy in the future?
Well, actually, that they're not forecasts, right? They're just projections of possible, plausible futures. And that actually, if you don't like that, say, outlook of this plausible future, that you really have a choice to change it. It's in your power to change that scenario and actually get a different outcome. But at the same time, right, that will need some vision and courage of policymakers, but also the public at large, to make those choices and these decisions. So in 2008, Shell developed two energy scenarios. They are a very long look ahead of the energy system to 2050. And the reason why we look so far ahead is because energy systems change very slowly over time. And that's all to do about how fast technology can actually be taken up by societies. So these scenarios actually are rooted in, say, human behavior, in the choices people make to shape their environment and shape their energy systems. And there were two archetypal behaviors. One was called the scramble type of behavior, where people really look after themselves in first instance, really take the easiest solutions, you know, stick with existing solutions, existing infrastructure, existing technologies. But that has its limitations. And when you don't change in time, right, you hit buffers that will bring volatility in prices, but also supply demand, and actually the adaptation periods of what you do next. And it's, in a sense, an uneasy world. On the other hand, we have a blueprint scenario where people are very much more anticipating change, and they don't want to delegate that transition to a collective agreement of states on a global level. They say, well, that's probably not going to happen, as we saw in Copenhagen. So let's just start ourselves. Right? We have the technology here at home, and we can do it now. So there's always entrepreneurs who actually promote these new technologies, but they have to get started. And one of these reasons to get started is to have a meaningful price for carbon, because if you have a meaningful price for carbon, that will stimulate these low carbon energy technologies. This carbon price, this carbon cost, is normally kept within your own economy. So basically, politicians have the opportunity to redistribute that pot of money to stimulate their own industry or, say, in collaboration with neighbors. And so innovation will accelerate under such systems, but also the incentive for energy efficiencies will accelerate under that kind of system. So blueprints is a very much more cooperative world, and a world that looks more further ahead. The people just get started and see where it ends. And one success is there, is emergence, it gets replicated and copied, and then you see this critical mass of success coalescing into a greater system, and then it goes from country to regional to hopefully global.
Would you like to maybe explain a little bit about what you meant by that? What policy changes that are going to be needed? How does that factor into what we're talking about?
Well, normally, so certainly in the scramble world, people like to stick to what they know best and what they can do best. So basically then you see a perpetuation of existing technologies. And new technologies always seems to be a bit scary and a bit more uncertain and certainly higher cost in the beginning. So you need to kind of vision where you want to have your energy system, say being low carbon and how fast. And then you have to actually say, okay, what kind of policies and regulations, being incentives like subsidies or taxing what you don't want, would need to be in place to achieve that. And one of the main policy instruments the world has is actually meaningful price for CO2 emissions. We believe that, say, a meaningful price really will be the most important policy instrument to actually make that energy transition to lower carbon fuels happen in the future.
What do you see happening with global population and how is that affecting the supply and demand of energy for everyone?
Right, the key drivers of energy demand growth is population growth, as you say, but also economic growth. Now, at the moment, we have 6.5 billion people on Earth. That's about twice as much as 50 years ago. And we're going for another 40-50% more people, around 9 billion people, say, by 2050. Now, all those people, they want prosperity, so they want their economies to grow. And especially the emerging economies, they need particularly, say, relatively to us in the West, more energy in that early phase of economic development when they industrialize and when they buy the first cars and the first fridges, etc. So as China, India are in that particular spurt in economic growth, the world can expect accelerated demand growth for all type of energies the coming decades.
Tell us about some of these new sources of energy that may seem unconventional to us today.
So as demand accelerates, right, say conventional, say easy access supply is really struggling to keep pace with that. So although you see, say, natural speed of innovation on demand and more efficiencies, right, and natural innovation and increase in supply, still that will not fill that gap completely. So you need a kind of extraordinary demand reduction, extraordinary supply acceleration in the coming times. Now, there are different ways of doing that. This demand reduction, obviously, you have the technological solutions like high efficient cars, more efficient fridges, etc. But also this extraordinary demand reduction will probably mean that we also will have to do things differently. So different ways of transport, we're going different ways to get still a very good life. On the other hand, on the supply side, right, we have to do things differently as well, because, say, conventional oil and gas resources and coal resources, they're not sufficient to keep pace with the demand growth. So we need new sources of supply, being it from renewables or from unconventional resources. If politicians and public at large are not aware that they need this extraordinary effort to bridge that supply-demand gap, then actually it can become pretty uncomfortable at some stages, and you can expect great volatility in prices and times of adjustments.
Tell us your thoughts on what's been described as a zone of uncertainty as we look ahead to the future of energy, and also what role unconventional energy sources, unconventional gas supplies will play in dealing with that zone of uncertainty.
Yeah, so when you look from today's perspective, or you can only see so far, and you can never really imagine what is around the horizon, right, of new technologies, new solutions. And who had thought just a couple of years ago that unconventional gas in North America would be such a success? But it is a success. And really, that is a kind of game changer, especially if we could replicate that success in North America elsewhere in the world. Because in the end, if you use gas-fired power generation instead of coal-fired power generation, you already have a factor two reduction in CO2 emissions. So that is a quick win, especially in this coming decade.
I guess the big question is how are we preparing for the future supply and demand of energy? What's being done now to prepare for this zone of uncertainty, uncertain conditions that we find ourselves in today?
So the global energy system is set to grow fast as it did in the past. We said that conventional supply will struggle to keep pace with that accelerated demand. So we'll have to make a transition to other supply sources as well, being unconventional hydrocarbon or more renewable resources. Now, all these things take time. You know, just to build new power station that can take anything between 5 and more years planning permission. And then you have to build it, and then it actually runs for another, say, 20, 40, or even longer years. So very much the decisions you make today really determines the energy system of the future, of your children and even of your grandchildren at some stage. So sense of urgency and decision making is important if you want to change the energy system, say, in 10, 20 years time. Because in the coming 10 years, maybe even 15 years, the energy system is already decided in that sense. And actually you see that we still need more hydrocarbon fuels, so oil, gas, coal, to make that transition to a lower carbon world. Now, people like to go faster and say, well, why can't we go straight away to renewables? But the answer down that is that all that new renewables need new infrastructure, and that takes time to build. It is a different way of operating. It may have need different market structure, it may need different legislation. It will certainly need kind of subsidies in the beginning to make the technology cost effective with existing technologies. So, and all that takes time to energy system to change.
You're saying that it's going to take time to build this, and the threat of climate change from greenhouse gases continues to build as well. Are we going to be able to reduce carbon emissions fast enough to achieve a sustainable energy future?
Well, that's very much a $64 million question in a sense, right? Can we do it fast enough? I would say that in technological sense, yes, we could. But can we politically, can we actually build the required change fast enough? And that is very much the question. And I think politicians, but also the public at large, have to make some courageous decisions to change, and to change now, if they really want that low carbon future fast.
You've been listening to Wim Thomas, head of the energy analysis team in Shell's Global Scenario Group. Among other things, he spoke of a need to anticipate and work cooperatively as population grows and emerging economies like China and India increase their energy needs. Our thanks today to Shell, encouraging dialogue on the energy challenge. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.